do you think you can go to New York and do this without our help? Asked the mother. I'm going to hire a home health aide. I'm looking to find someone starting now, actually. I don't want strangers taking care of her. They're not going to hug her and love her like we do, said the actress. And a stranger isn't going to know her history and memories like we do. We can sometimes fill in her holes and read her body language, and that's because we know her, said the mother. I'm not saying that we won't still take care of her. I'm just being realistic and practical. We don't have to shoulder this entirely ourselves. You'll be going back to work in a couple of months and coming home every night to two babies you haven't seen all day. And you're starting school. You keep talking about how intense the program is. Tom's in surgery as we speak. You're all about to be busier than you've ever been, and your mother would be the last person to want you to compromise the quality of your own lives for her. She'd never want to be a burden to you. She's not a burden, she's our mother, said the mother. They were talking too quickly and using too many pronouns, and the baby in pink had begun to fuss and cry, distracting her. Alice couldn't figure out what or who they were talking about, but she could tell by their facial expressions and the tones that it was a serious argument, and the woman in pajamas were on the same side. Maybe it makes more sense for me to take a longer maternity leave. I'm feeling a little rushed, and Charlie's okay with me taking more time, and it makes more sense for being around for Mom. Dad, this is our last chance to spend time with her. You can't go to New York. You can't take that away. Look, if you'd accepted at NYU instead of Brandeis, you could have spent all the time you wanted with her. You made your choice. I'm making mine. Why doesn't Mom get a say in this choice? Asked the mother. She doesn't want to live in New York, said the actress. You don't know what she wants, said John. She said she doesn't want to go. Go ahead and ask her. Just because she has Alzheimer's doesn't mean she doesn't know what she does and doesn't want. At 3 in the morning, she wanted scrambled eggs and toast, and she didn't want cereal or bacon. And she definitely didn't want to go back to bed. You're choosing to dismiss what she wants because she has Alzheimer's, said the actress. Oh, they're talking about me. I'm not dismissing what she wants. I'm doing the best I can to do what's right for both of us. If she got everything she unilaterally wanted, we wouldn't even be having this conversation. What the hell does that mean? Asked the mother. Nothing. It's like you don't get that she's not gone yet. Like you think her time left isn't meaningful anymore. You're acting like a selfish child, said the mother. The mother was crying now, but she seemed angry. She looked and sounded like Alice's sister, Anne. But she couldn't be Anne. That was impossible. Anne didn't have any children. How do you know she thinks this is meaningful? Look, it's not just me. The old her, before this, she wouldn't want me to give this up. She didn't want to be here like this, said John. What does that mean? Asked the crying woman who looked and sounded like Anne. Nothing. Look, I understand and appreciate everything you're saying, but I'm trying to make a decision that's rational and not emotional. Why? What's wrong with being emotional about this? Why is that a negative thing? Why isn't the emotional decision the right decision? Asked the woman who wasn't crying. I haven't come to a final decision yet, and the two of you aren't going to bully me into one. You don't know everything. So tell us, Dad, tell us what we don't know, said the crying woman, her voice shaking and threatening. The threat silenced him for a moment. I don't have time for this now. I have a meeting. He got up and abandoned the argument, leaving the women and the babies alone. He slammed the front door as he left the house, startling the baby in blue, which had just fallen asleep in the mother's arms. It wailed. As if it were contagious, the other woman began crying too. Maybe she just felt left out. Now everyone was crying, the pink baby, the blue baby, the mother, and the woman next to the mother. Everyone except Alice. She wasn't sad or angry or defeated or scared. She was hungry. What are we having for dinner? May 2005. They reached the counter after waiting a long time in a long line. All right, Alice, what do you want? Asked John. I'll have whatever you're having. I'm getting vanilla. That's fine, I'll have that. You don't want vanilla, you want something chocolate. Okay then, I'll have something chocolate. It seemed simple and unproblematic enough to her, but he became visibly stressed by the exchange. I'll have a vanilla in a cone, and she'll have a chocolate fudge brownie in a cone, both large. Away from the stores and crowded lines of people, they sat on a graffiti-covered bench on the edge of a river and ate their ice creams. Several geese nibbled in the grass just a few feet away. The geese kept their heads down, consumed in the business of nibbling, completely unbothered by Alice and John's presence. Alice giggled, wondering if the geese thought the same thing about them. Alice, do you know what month it is? It had rained earlier, but the sky was clear now, and the heat from the sun and the dry bench warmed her bones. It felt so good to be warm. Many of the pink and white blossoms from the crabapple tree next to them were scattered across the ground like party confetti. It's spring. What month of spring? Alice licked her something chocolate ice cream and carefully considered his question. She couldn't remember the last time she'd looked at a calendar. It had been a long time, it seemed, since she needed to be at a certain place at a certain time. Or if she did need to be somewhere on a certain day at a certain time, John knew about it for her and made sure she got there when she was supposed to. She didn't use an appointment machine, and she no longer wore a wrist clock. Well, let's see. The months of the year. I don't know. What is it? May. Oh. Do you know when Anna's birthday is? Is it in May? No. Well, I think Anne's birthday is in the spring. No, not Anne. Anna. A yellow truck groaned loudly over the bridge near them and startled Alice. One of the geese spread its wings and honked at the truck, defending them. Alice wondered whether it was brave or a hothead, looking for a fight. She giggled, thinking about the feisty goose. She licked her something chocolate ice cream and studied the architecture of the red brick building across the river. It had many windows and a clock with old-fashioned numbers on a gold dome on its top. It looked important and familiar. "What's that building over there?" asked Alice. "That's the business school. It's part of Harvard." "Oh. Did I teach in that building?" "No, you taught in a different building on this side of the river." "Oh. Alice, where's your office?" "My office? It's at Harvard." "Yes, but where at Harvard?" "In a building on this side of the river." "Which building?" "It's in a hall, I think. You know, I don't go there anymore." "I know." "Then it really doesn't matter where it is, right? Why don't we focus on the things that really matter?" "I'm trying." He held her hand. His was warmer than hers. Her hand felt so good in his hand. Two of the geese waddled into the calm water. There were no people swimming in the river. It was probably too cold for people. "Alice, do you still want to be here?" His eyebrows bent into a serious shape, and the creases next to his eyes deepened. This question was important to him. She smiled, pleased with herself for finally having a confident answer for him. "Yes, I like sitting here with you, and I'm not done yet." She held up her something chocolate ice cream to show him. It had started to melt and drip down the sides of the cone onto her hand. "Why, do we need to leave now?" she asked. "No, take your time." June 2005. Alice sat at her computer waiting for the screen to come to life. Kathy had just called, checking in, concerned. She said that Alice hadn't returned her emails in a while, that she hadn't been to the dementia chat room in weeks, and that she'd missed support group again yesterday. It wasn't until Kathy talked about support group that Alice knew who the concerned Kathy on the phone was. Kathy said that two new people had joined their support group, and that it had been recommended to them by people who had attended the dementia care conference and had heard Alice's speech. Alice told her that was wonderful news. She apologized to Kathy for worrying her and told her to let everyone know that she was okay. But to tell the truth, she was very far from okay. She could still read and comprehend small amounts of text, but the computer keyboard had become an undecipherable jumble of letters. In truth, she'd lost the ability to compose words out of the alphabet letters on the keys. Her ability to use language, that thing that most separates humans from animals, was leaving her, and she was feeling less and less human as it departed. She'd said a tearful goodbye to OK some time ago. She clicked on her mailbox. 73 new emails. Overwhelmed and powerless to respond, she closed out of her email application without opening anything. She stared at the screen she'd spent much of her professional life in front of. 3 folders sat on the desktop arranged in a vertical row. Hard drive, Alice, Butterfly. She clicked on the Alice folder. Inside were more folders with different titles. Abstracts, administrative, classes, conferences, figures, grant proposals, home, John, kids, lunch seminars, molecules to mind, papers, presentations, students. Her entire life organized into neat little icons. She couldn't bear to look inside, afraid she wouldn't remember or understand her entire life. She clicked on Butterfly instead. Dear Alice, you wrote this letter to yourself when you were of sound mind. If you are reading this and you are unable to answer one or more of the following questions, then you are no longer of sound mind. What month is it? Where do you live? Where is your office? When is Anna's birthday? How many children do you have? You have Alzheimer's disease. You have lost too much of yourself, too much of what you love, and you are not living the life you want to live. There is no good outcome to this disease, but you have chosen an outcome that is the most dignified, fair, and respectful to you and your family. You can no longer trust your own judgment, but you can trust mine, your former self, you before Alzheimer's took too much of you away. You lived an extraordinary and worthwhile life. You and your husband John have 3 healthy and amazing children who are all loved and doing well in the world. And you had a remarkable career at Harvard filled with challenge, creativity, passion, and accomplishment. This last part of your life, the part with Alzheimer's, and this end that you've carefully chosen is tragic. But you did not live a tragic life. I love you, and I'm proud of you, of how you've lived and all that you've done while you could. Now, go to your bedroom. Go to the black table next to the bed, the one with the blue lamp on it. Open the drawer to that table. In the back of the drawer is a bottle of pills. The bottle has a white label on it that says "For Alice" in black letters. There are a lot of pills in that bottle. Swallow all of them with a big glass of water. Make sure you swallow all of them. Then get in bed and go to sleep. Go now before you forget, and do not tell anyone what you're doing. Please trust me. Love, Alice Howland. She read it again. She didn't remember writing it. She didn't know the answers to any of the questions but the one asking the number of children she had. But then she probably knew that because she'd provided the answer in the letter. She couldn't be sure of their names. Anna and Charlie, maybe? She couldn't remember the other one. She read it again, more slowly this time, if that was even possible. Reading on a computer screen was difficult, more difficult than reading on paper, where she could use a pen and highlighter. And paper she could take with her to her bedroom and read it there. She wanted to print it out, but couldn't figure out how to make that happen. She wished her former self, she before Alzheimer's took too much of her away, had known to include instructions for printing it out. She read it again. It was fascinating and surreal, like reading a diary that had been hers when she was a teenager, secret and heartfelt words written by a girl she only vaguely remembered. She wished she'd written more. Her words made her feel sad and proud, powerful and relieved. She took a deep breath, exhaled, and went upstairs. She got to the top of the stairs and forgot what she had gone up there to do. It carried a sense of importance and urgency, but nothing else. She went back downstairs and looked for evidence of where she'd just been. She found the computer on with a letter to her displayed on the screen. She read it and went back upstairs. She opened the drawer in a table next to the bed. She pulled out packets of tissues, pens, a stack of sticky paper, a bottle of lotion, a couple of cough candies, dental floss, and some coins. She spread everything out on the bed and touched each item, one at a time. Tissues, pen, 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 sticky paper, coins, candy, candy, floss, lotion. Alice? What? She spun around. John stood in the doorway. What are you doing up here? He asked. She looked at the items on the bed. Looking for something. I have to run back to the office to pick up a paper I forgot. I'm going to drive, so I'll only be gone for a few minutes. Okay. Here, it's time. Take these before I forget. He handed her a glass of water and a handful of pills. She swallowed each one. Thank you, she said. You're welcome. I'll be right back. He took the empty glass from her and left the room. She lay down on the bed next to the former contents of the drawer and closed her eyes, feeling sad and proud, powerful and relieved, as she waited. Alice, please, put your robe, hood, and cap on. We need to leave. Where are we going? Asked Alice. Harvard commencement. She inspected the costume again. She still didn't get it. What does commencement mean? It's Harvard graduation day. Commencement means beginning. Commencement. Graduation from Harvard. A beginning. She turned the word over in her mind. Graduation from Harvard marked a beginning. The beginning of adulthood. The beginning of professional life. The beginning of life after Harvard. Commencement. She liked the word and wanted to remember it. They walked along a busy sidewalk wearing their dark pink costumes and plush black hats. She felt conspicuously ridiculous and entirely untrusting of John's wardrobe decision for the first several minutes of their walk. Then, suddenly, they were everywhere. Masses of people in similar costumes and hats, but in a variety of colors funneled from every direction onto the sidewalk with them, and soon they were all walking in a rainbow costume parade. They entered a grassy yard, shaded by big old trees and surrounded by big old buildings to the slow ceremonial sounds of bagpipes. Alice shivered with goosebumps. I've done this before. The procession led them to a row of chairs where they sat down. This is Harvard graduation, said Alice. Yes, said John. Commencement. Yes. After some time, the speakers began. Harvard graduation's past had featured many famous and powerful people, mostly political leaders. The King of Spain spoke here one year, said Alice. Yes, said John. He laughed a little, amused. Who is this man? Asked Alice, referring to the man at the podium. He's an actor, said John. Now Alice laughed, amused. I guess they couldn't get a king this year, said Alice. You know, your daughter is an actress. She could be up there someday, said John. Alice listened to the actor. He was an easy and dynamic speaker. He kept talking about a picaresque. What's a picaresque? Asked Alice. It's a long adventure that teaches the hero lessons. The actor talked about his life's adventure. He told them he was here today to pass on to them, the graduating classes, the people about to begin their own picaresques, the lessons he'd learned along his way. He gave them 5. Be creative, be useful, be practical, be generous, and finish big. I've been all those things, I think, except I haven't finished yet. I haven't finished big. That's good advice, said Alice. Yes, it is, said John. They sat and listened and clapped and listened and clapped for longer than Alice cared to. Then everyone stood and walked slowly in a less orderly parade. Alice and John and some of the others entered a nearby building. The magnificent entryway, with its staggeringly high, dark wooden ceiling and towering wall of sunlit stained glass, awed Alice. Huge, old, and heavy-looking chandeliers loomed over them. "What is this?" asked Alice. "This is Memorial Hall. It's part of Harvard." To her disappointment, they spent no time in the magnificent entryway and moved immediately into a smaller, relatively unimpressive theater room where they sat down. "What's happening now?" asked Alice. "The Graduate School of Arts and Sciences students are getting their PhDs. We're here to see Dan graduate. He's your student." She looked around the room at the faces of the people in the dark pink costumes. She didn't know which one was Dan. She didn't, in fact, recognize any of the faces, but she did recognize the emotion and the energy in the room. They were happy and hopeful, proud and relieved. They were ready and eager for new challenges, to discover and create and teach, to be the heroes in their own adventures. What she saw in them, she recognized in herself. This was something she knew, this place, this excitement and readiness, this beginning. This had been the beginning of her adventure, too, and although she couldn't remember the details, she had an implicit knowing that it had been rich and worthwhile. "There he is, on stage," said John.
"Who?"
"Dan, your student."
"Which one?"
"The blonde."
"Daniel Maloney," someone announced.
Dan stepped forward and shook hands with the man on the stage in exchange for a red folder. Dan then raised the red folder high over his head and smiled in glorious victory. For his joy, for all that he had surely achieved to be here, for the adventure that he would embark on, Alice applauded him, this student of hers whom she had no memory of. Alice and John stood outside under a big white tent among the students in dark pink costumes and the people who were happy for them, and waited. A young blonde man approached Alice, grinning broadly. Unhesitating, he hugged her and kissed her on the cheek.
"I'm Dan Maloney, your student."
"Congratulations, Dan. I'm so happy for you," said Alice.
"Thank you so much. I'm so glad you were able to come and see me graduate. I feel so lucky to have been your student. I want you to know, you were the reason I chose linguistics as my field of study. Your passion for understanding how language works, your rigorous and collaborative approach to research, your love of teaching, you've inspired me in so many ways. Thank you for all your guidance and wisdom, for setting the bar so much higher than I thought I could reach, and for giving me plenty of room to run with my own ideas. You've been the best teacher I've ever had. If I achieve in my life a fraction of what you've accomplished in yours, I'll consider my life a success."
"You're welcome. Thank you for saying that. You know, I don't remember so well these days. I'm glad to know that you'll remember these things about me." He handed her a white envelope.
"Here, I wrote it all down for you, everything I just said, so you can read it whenever you want and know what you gave to me even if you can't remember."
"Thank you."
They each held their envelopes, hers white and his red, with deep pride and reverence. An older, heavier version of Dan and two women, one much older than the other, came over to them. The older, heavier version of Dan carried a tray of bubbly white wine and skinny glasses. The young woman handed a glass to each of them.
"To Dan," said the older, heavier version of Dan, holding up his glass.
"To Dan," said everyone, clinking the skinny glasses and taking sips.
"To auspicious beginnings," added Alice, "and finishing big." They began walking away from the tents and the old brick buildings and the people in costumes and hats to where it was less populated and noisy. Someone in a black costume yelled and ran over to John. John stopped and let go of Alice's hand to shake hands with the person who had yelled. Caught in her own forward momentum, Alice kept walking. For a stretched-out second, Alice paused and made eye contact with a woman. She was sure she didn't know the woman, but there was meaning in the exchange. The woman had blonde hair, a phone by her ear, and glasses over her big blue startled eyes. The woman was driving in a car. Then Alice's hood pulled suddenly tight around her throat, and she was jerked backward. She landed hard and unsuspecting on her back and banged her head on the ground. Her costume and plush hat offered little protection against the pavement. "I'm sorry, Allie, are you okay?" asked a man in a dark pink robe, kneeling beside her. "No," she said, sitting up and rubbing the back of her head. She expected to see blood on her hand, but didn't. "I'm sorry, you walked right into the street. That car almost hit you." "Is she okay?" It was the woman from the car, her eyes still big and startled. "I think so," said the man. "Oh my God, I could have killed her. If you didn't pull her out of the way, I might have killed her." "It's okay. You didn't kill her. I think she's okay." The man helped Alice stand. He felt and looked at her head. "I think you're all right. You're probably going to be really sore. Can you walk?" he asked. "Yes." "Can I give you a ride somewhere?" asked the woman. "No, no, that's all right. We're fine," said the man. He put his arm around Alice's waist and his hand under her elbow, and she walked home with the kind stranger who had saved her life. Summer, 2005. Alice sat in a big, comfortable white chair and puzzled over the clock on the wall. It was the kind with hands and numbers, which was much harder to read than the kind with just numbers. 5, maybe? "What time is it?" she asked the man sitting in the other big white chair. He looked at his wrist. "Almost 3:30. "I think it's time for me to go home." "You are home. This is your home on the Cape." She looked around the room, the white furniture, the pictures of lighthouses and beaches on the walls, the giant windows, the spindly little trees outside the windows. "No, this isn't my house. I don't live here. I want to go home now." "We're going back to Cambridge in a couple of weeks. We're here on vacation. You like it here." The man in the chair continued reading his book and drinking his drink. The book was thick and the drink was yellowish brown, like the color of her eyes, with ice in it. He was enjoying and absorbed in both the book and the drink. The white furniture, the pictures of lighthouses and beaches on the walls, the giant windows, and the spindly little trees outside the windows didn't look at all familiar to her. The sounds here weren't familiar to her either. She heard birds, the kind that live at the ocean, the sound of the ice swirling and clinking in the glass when the man in the chair drank his drink, the sound of the man breathing through his nose as he read his book, and the ticking of the clock. "I think I've been here long enough. I'd like to go home now." "You are home. This is your vacation home. This is where we come to relax and unwind." This place didn't look like her home or sound like her home, and she didn't feel relaxed. The man reading and drinking in the big white chair didn't know what he was talking about. Maybe he was drunk. The man breathed and read and drank, and the clock ticked. Alice sat in the big white chair and listened to the time go by, wishing someone would take her home. She sat in one of the white wooden chairs on a deck drinking iced tea and listening to the shrill crosstalk of unseen frogs and twilight bugs. "Hey, Alice, I found your butterfly necklace," said the man who owned the house. He dangled a jeweled butterfly by a silver chain in front of her. "That's not my necklace, that's my mother's. And it's special, so you'd better put it back. We're not supposed to play with it." "I talked to your mom, and she said that you could have it. She's giving it to you." She studied his eyes and mouth and body language, looking for some sign that would give away his motive. But before she could get a proper read on his sincerity, the beauty of the sparkling blue butterfly seduced her, overriding her rule-abiding concerns. "She said I could have it?" "Uh-huh." He leaned over her from behind and fastened it around her neck. She ran her fingers over the blue gems on the wings, the silver body, and the diamond-studded antennae. She felt a smug thrill rush through her. Anne's gonna be so jealous. She sat on the floor in front of the full-length mirror in the bedroom she slept in and examined her reflection. The girl in the mirror had sunken, darkened circles under her eyes. Her skin looked loose and spotty all over, and wrinkled at the corners of her eyes and along her forehead. Her thick, scraggly eyebrows needed to be tweezed. Her curly hair was mostly black, but it was also noticeably gray. The girl in the mirror looked ugly and old. She ran her fingers over her cheeks and forehead, feeling her face on her fingers and her fingers on her face. That can't be me. What's wrong with my face? The girl in the mirror sickened her. She found the bathroom and flicked on the light. She met the same image in the mirror over the sink. There were her golden brown eyes, her serious nose, her heart-shaped lips, but everything else, the composition around her features, was grotesquely wrong. She ran her fingers over the smooth, cool glass. What's wrong with these mirrors? The bathroom didn't smell right either. Two shiny white step stools, a brush, and a bucket sat on sheets of newspaper on the floor behind her. She squatted down and breathed in through her serious nose. She pried the lid off the bucket, dipped the brush in, and watched creamy white paint dribble down. She started with the ones she knew were defective, the one in the bathroom and the one in the bedroom she slept in. She found four more before she was finished and painted them all white. She sat in a big white chair, and the man who owned the house sat in the other one. The man who owned the house was reading a book and drinking a drink. The book was thick, and the drink was yellowish-brown with ice in it. She picked up an even thicker book than the one the man was reading from the coffee table and thumbed through it. Her eyes paused on diagrams of words and letters connected to other words and letters by arrows, dashes, and little lollipops. She landed on individual words as she browsed through the pages. Disinhibition, phosphorylation, genes, acetylcholine, priming, transients, demons, morphemes, phonological. "I think I've read this book before," said Alice. The man looked over at the book she held and then at her. "You've done more than that. You wrote it. You and I wrote that book together." Hesitant to take him at his word, she closed the book and read the shiny blue cover. "From Molecules to Mind," by John Howland, Ph.D. and Alice Howland, Ph.D. She looked up at the man in the chair. "He's John." She flipped to the front pages. Table of contents. Mood and emotion. Motivation. Arousal and attention. Memory. Language. Language. She opened the book to somewhere near the end. An infinite possibility of expression. Learned, yet instinctive. Semanticity. Syntax. Case grammar. Irregular verbs. Effortless and automatic. Universal. The words she read seemed to push past the choking weeds and sludge in her mind to a place that was pristine and still intact, hanging on. "John," she said. "Yes." He put his book down and sat up straight at the edge of his big white chair. "I wrote this book with you," she said. "Yes. I remember. I remember you. I remember I used to be very smart." "Yes, you were. You were the smartest person I've ever known." This thick book with the shiny blue cover represented so much of what she used to be. "I used to know how the mind handled language, and I could communicate what I knew. I used to be someone who knew a lot. No one asked for my opinion or advice anymore. I miss that. I used to be curious and independent and confident. I miss being sure of things. There's no peace in being unsure of everything all the time. I miss doing everything easily. I miss being a part of what's happening. I miss feeling wanted. I miss my life and my family. I loved my life and family." She wanted to tell him everything she remembered and thought, but she couldn't send all those memories and thoughts, composed of so many words, phrases, and sentences, past the choking weeds and sludge into audible sound. She boiled it down and put all her effort into what was most essential. The rest would have to remain in the pristine place, hanging on. I miss myself. I miss you too, Allie, so much. I never planned to get like this. I know. September 2005. John sat at the end of a long table and took a large sip from his black coffee. It tasted extremely strong and bitter, but he didn't care. He didn't drink it for its taste. He'd drink it faster if he could, but it was scalding hot. He'd need 2 or 3 more large cups before he'd become fully alert and functional. Most of the people who came in bought their caffeine to go and hurried on their way. John didn't have lab meeting for another hour, and he felt no compelling pressure to get to his office early today. He was content to take his time, eat his cinnamon scone, drink his coffee, and read the New York Times. He opened to the health section first, as he'd done with every newspaper he'd read for over a year now, a habit that had long ago replaced most of the hope that originally inspired the behavior. He read the first article on the page and cried openly as his coffee cooled. Amylyx fails trial. According to the results of Synapsin's Phase 3 study, patients with mild to moderate Alzheimer's disease who took Amylyx during the 15-month trial failed to show a significant stabilization of dementia symptoms compared with placebo. Amylyx is a selective amyloid beta-lowering agent. By binding soluble A-beta-42, this experimental drug's aim is to stop progression of the disease and is unlike the drugs currently available to patients with Alzheimer's, which can at best only delay the disease's ultimate course. The drug was well tolerated and sailed through phases 1 and 2 with much clinical promise and Wall Street expectation. But after a little over a year on the medication, the cognitive functioning of the patients receiving even the highest dose of Amylyx failed to show improvement or stabilization as measured by the Alzheimer's Disease Assessment Scale and scores on activities of daily living, and they declined at a rate that was significant and expected. Epilogue. Alice sat on a bench with the woman and watched the children walking by them. Not really children. They weren't the kind of small children who lived at home with their mothers. What were they? Medium children. She studied the faces of the medium children as they walked. Serious, busy, heavy-headed. Headed on their way somewhere. There were other benches nearby, but none of the medium children stopped to sit. Everyone walked, busy on their way to where they must go. She didn't need to go anywhere. She felt lucky about this. She and the woman she sat with listened to the girl with very long hair play her music and sing. The girl had a lovely voice and big, happy teeth and a lot of skirt with flowers all over it that Alice admired. Alice hummed along to the music. She liked the sound of her hum blended with the voice of the singing girl. "Okay, Alice, Lydia will be home any minute. You want to pay Sonia before we go?" asked the woman. The woman was standing, smiling, and holding money. Alice felt invited to join her. She got up, and the woman handed her the money. Alice dropped it in the black hat on the brick ground by the singing girl's feet. The singing girl kept playing her music but stopped singing for a moment to talk to them. "Thanks, Alice. Thanks, Carol. See you soon." As Alice walked with the woman among the medium children, the music became quieter behind them. Alice didn't really want to leave, but the woman was going, and Alice knew she should stay with her. The woman was cheerful and kind and always knew what to do, which Alice appreciated because she often didn't. After walking for some time, Alice spotted the red clown car and the big nail polish car parked in the driveway. "They're both here," said the woman, seeing the same cars. Alice felt excited and hurried into the house. The mother was in the hallway. "My meeting ended quicker than I thought it would, so I came back. Thanks for filling in," said the mother. "No problem. I stripped her bed but didn't have a chance to remake it. Everything's still in the dryer," said the woman. "Okay, thanks. I'll get it." "She had another good day." "No wandering?" "Nope. She's my trusty shadow now. My partner in crime, right, Alice? The woman smiled, nodding enthusiastically. Alice smiled and nodded back. She had no idea what she was agreeing to, but it was probably fine with her if the woman thought so. The woman began collecting books and bags by the front door. "Is John coming up tomorrow?" asked the woman. A baby they couldn't see started crying, and the mother disappeared into another room. "No, but we've got it covered," said the mother's voice. The mother came back carrying a baby dressed in blue, kissing him repeatedly on the neck. The baby still cried, but his heart really wasn't in it anymore. The mother's fast kisses were working. The mother plugged a sucking thing into the baby's mouth. "You're okay, little goose. Thanks, Carol, so much. You're a godsend. Have a great weekend. See you Monday." "See you Monday. Bye, Lydia," the woman yelled. "Bye, thanks, Carol," a voice yelled from somewhere in the house. The baby's big, round eyes met Alice's, and he smiled in recognition behind his sucking thing. Alice smiled back, and the baby responded with a wide-mouthed laugh. The sucking thing fell to the floor. The mother squatted down and picked it up. "Mom, you want to hold him for me?" The mother passed the baby to Alice, and he slid comfortably into her arms and on her hip. He began pawing at her face with one of his wet hands. He liked doing this, and Alice liked letting him. He grabbed her bottom lip. She pretended to bite it and eat it while making wild animal noises. He laughed and moved on to her nose. She sniffed and sniffed and pretended to sneeze. He moved up to her eyes. She squinted so she wouldn't get poked and blinked to try to tickle his hand with her eyelashes. He moved his hand up her forehead to her hair, tightened his little fist, and pulled. She gently unclenched his hand and replaced her hair with her index finger. He found her necklace. "See the pretty butterfly?" "Don't let him put that in his mouth," called the mother, who was in another room but within eyeshot. Alice wasn't about to let the baby mouth her necklace, and she felt wrongly accused. She walked into the room where the mother was. It was crowded with all kinds of birthday party-colored baby seat things that beeped and buzzed and talked when the babies banged on them. Alice had forgotten that this was the room with all the loud seats. She wanted to leave before the mother suggested she put the baby in one of them. But the actress was in here, too, and Alice wanted to be in their company. "Is Dad coming this weekend?" asked the actress. "No, he can't. He said next week." "Can I leave them with you and Mom for a little while? I need to go to the store. Allison should sleep another hour." "Sure." "I'll be quick. Need anything?" the mother asked as she walked out of the room. "More ice cream. Something chocolate," yelled the actress. Alice found a soft toy with no noisy buttons and sat down while the baby explored it in her lap. She smelled the top of his almost bald head and watched the actress read. The actress looked up at her. "Hey, Mom, will you listen to me do this monologue I'm working on for class and tell me what you think it's about? Not the story, it's kind of long. You don't have to remember the words, just tell me what you think it's about emotionally. When I'm done, tell me how I made you feel, okay?" Alice nodded, and the actress began. Alice watched and listened and focused beyond the words the actress spoke. She saw her eyes become desperate, searching, pleading for truth. She saw them land softly and gratefully on it. Her voice felt at first tentative and scared. Slowly and without getting louder, it grew more confident and then joyful, playing sometimes like a song. Her eyebrows and shoulders and hands softened and opened, asking for acceptance and offering forgiveness. Her voice and body created an energy that filled Alice and moved her to tears. She squeezed the beautiful baby in her lap and kissed his sweet-smelling head. The actress stopped and came back into herself. She looked at Alice and waited. "Okay, what do you feel?" "I feel love. It's about love." The actress squealed, rushed over to Alice, kissed her on the cheek and smiled, every crease of her face delighted. "Did I get it right?" asked Alice. "You did, Mom. You got it exactly right." Postscript. The clinical trial drug Amylyx described in this book is fictional. It is, however, similar to real compounds in clinical development that aim to selectively lower levels of amyloid beta 42. Unlike the currently available drugs, which can only delay the disease's ultimate progression, it is hoped that these drugs will stop the progression of Alzheimer's. All other drugs mentioned are real, and the depiction of their use and efficacy in the treatment of Alzheimer's disease is accurate as of the writing of this story. For more information about Alzheimer's disease and clinical trials, go to www.alz.org.
Still Alice was written and read by Lisa Genova. It was recorded at Morris Creative Services in Northeastham, Massachusetts. Editing and post-production by Common Mode. Paul Fowley, Technical Director. It was mixed by Terry Hogan. The associate producer was Travis Tun. Still Alice was produced and directed by Carol Shapiro. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.